See, you thanks turn the very button much. On.
Got it. Thanks, Steve.
Pleasure.
I hate to start out on a sad note, but because of the story that's going on with AJ Friend, I know the newsroom must be insane this morning. What are we waiting on exactly, Steve? What is the next move exactly?
Well, the police in Crystal Lake have called a news conference for noon, during which time I expect to hear more. Clearly, there were search warrants allowed because we saw investigators taking several items from the home, from the boy's home this morning. His mom, or rather his mom's attorney at any rate, was at the Crystal Lake Police Department very early this morning. Also in the Woodstock area, there were some searches going on. TV helicopters, Channel 9 and others were able to watch from above as they were looking at some area. Not sure what's coming from that, but it does look as if there's been movement on several fronts here on this story today.
I want this solved. We were playing yesterday, was it on the stream where we played the 911 call?
We did, yeah.
I know John Williams and you, Steve, played it yesterday.
I don't play them usually, generally.
I don't know that we should have access to those.
Ever? Or
well, I feel a little guilty because I did judge the father not being in a panic mode. And then I was bothered by that all night because I don't know the outcome of this. And I felt bad judging. I don't need to have that 911 information.
They're public record, and sometimes there are reasons for them to be released to the public. So I don't know that they should be shut down. But generally, a 911 call doesn't tell you too much, and shows people at their absolute
worst. Yep.
Vulnerable and painful.
Yep.
And I just think it's...
Steve, in this particular instance, though, his father didn't sound at his absolute worst. He was actually far more cool and collected than you would expect somebody to be under those circumstances.
Okay, but right? but
people react differently.
But you don't know anything about that, Bill.
I don't.
And people listen to it and then make judgments.
Right.
And that's you know what I feel guilty about.
The one I think of was William Shatner's wife.
Right.
When she drowned and he came home and found her in a pool.
Yes.
And his 911 tape was released. And, you know, it's been a while ago, so my memory's not great. But as I recall, he was just distraught and, you know,
right.
Gasping. And it just was such a private moment.
That why did we need to hear that? I guess that's what I'm saying. And yeah, it didn't advance the case any releasing this information yesterday. It wasn't like asking the public's
right.
help.
Yeah.
I just maybe after it's solved, but even then,
the question is who is it who's
benefiting from this?
No, who is it who doesn't use it? I mean, it's public record, and there are times when you know there might be a story about 911 operators behaving badly or missing information, and so you would need to have access to that to cover it fairly, right?
Yeah.
So I don't want to live in a world where these tapes are no longer accessible to reporters or to the public. So I think instead, and this will never happen, but the policing should be, once they're released to the public, who plays them and how do we use them?
All right, you know? I agree with that. Because if I'm ever, hopefully I never have to call 911. If I do, I don't want to have to worry about how I'm portrayed later on when that's released.
Right.
I'm serious.
No,
it would go into your head for a minute, like, boy, this. What you just have to have a reaction, and I know it's the freedom of information, but why do I need to hear that?
Well, I'll explain why you need to hear it. Because there's a curiosity when you hear a story like this. It's such a freakish thing, and you're entertaining the idea that a child could have potentially. This is just an idea. I know nothing's been proved. But there's a chance that this little boy was killed by his mother or his father or both. So just as an average person, which I consider myself to be, and I'm sure you do too, you say to yourself, I'm so curious about this. I want to take in as much information as I can, good, bad, or indifferent. And it's true. You do make a judgment, an unfair judgment based on what you're hearing. But still, it's helping you somehow in your mind piece things together.
And when something like this happens, I can't wait for the solution.
Sure.
I am all over it. I said they shouldn't be released. They shouldn't be out there. And you said, but did you listen
to
it?
You listened.
I did, but if it wasn't out there, I wouldn't have.
But cocaine is out there. Are you snorting cocaine?
All right, that is a... I don't see the connection there.
Wendy, I haven't listened to it, and it's out there.
You really haven't?
No, I haven't. You know, there's two things. There's one, like, we all think we're Columbos, and that's going to give us a clue.
Yeah.
Which isn't good. But the other thing is, it's a very human drama. to have someone, you know, that we all sort of fear or live in consideration of. And so I think we put ourselves in that position somehow, right? So you want to identify with someone who's going through that. Does that make any sense?
Yes. It does make sense.
It does. And it causes you to judge people, because I heard it yesterday, and he did sound very calm and, you know, not panicky. And I thought, oh, that's weird.
I mean, you ask a 911 operator, what's more useful, someone who's distraught or someone who's very calm? I would think of someone who's very calm
yeah,
would be better for the immediate situation.
But if your kid is missing, I would think I would not be calm.
But that is you. And I agree, Mary, 100%. I would be like crazed. Like, oh, my God. But now I'm thinking, like, my brother is very organized and methodical and calm, cool, and collected and great in emergency situations. And I was thinking of my brother calling 911, and I could see him saying, okay, here are the facts. You know, my sister-in-law would be going nuts, but it's usually there's one that's frantic and one that can keep things together.
Also, at this point in the story, we're days into this little boy's disappearance. At the time, they had just woken up and he wasn't in bed. So I'm sure part of him was saying anything could have been.
He's got to be somewhere.
Anything could happen at this stage, right? We weren't days into it. We were hours into it at the time. So
I don't like judging people, and I do it a lot, and I'm sorry. And it was put out there to judge, in my opinion.
I don't know if it was put out there to judge so much as it was put out there just because it was part of it was information pertinent to the case, right? So no one would base guilt just strictly on a 911 tape.
We all
did. It did help you formulate an opinion, certainly, you know. But when I heard it, like, your reaction was very, very different. You kept saying yesterday, how could he be so calm under these circumstances? And I said essentially what I just said a little while ago, which is, he woke up, the little boy wasn't in the bed, he was trying to rationalize it. Could he have just walked out? Did he go somewhere? Did he see a friend out the window and just take a walk with him?
And my reaction is not necessarily anyone else's reaction. I lost Michael at the Children's Museum, and I was a crazed lunatic.
Oh, yeah. Well, who hasn't gone shopping with their kid, and the kid is playing under a display of
that
coats
happened at
or
Kohl's
something
with Dylan?
It's happened to everybody. Even though it's just it's 20 seconds later, and you just go, what if I'm one of those stories where the kid is gone?
Whenever that happens, it's like time is just zooming past you. Like, you feel like a movie camera's on and everything's going just so fast and you're frantic.
Yes.
I just...
And that little turd is hiding under the clothes.
Under the coat.
I know.
That happened to me, too.
Yeah.
And he's giggling.
I know.
Of course.
At our reaction.
And there's no way to convey to a small child the fear that's involved when something like that happens, because they're not buying into that.
You know what you do? You do it back to them.
Right.
While they're looking in the toy section, you go hide somewhere, and then they freak out.
Yeah.
And no one buys them a toy.
They'll remember that for a long time.
At noon, we will be running this press conference, and we are on the stream at noon, and I would like to run that if that's
cool. Of course.
I am just dying to know what's going on.
Yeah.
And I need to know what happened to AJ.
It's such a sad story. What are your thoughts on this? Should these tapes be released, these 911 tapes? How does it change things? We're at 312-981-7200. You can call us or text us. More ahead, Bill and Wendy, WGN. All right, it's us. It's Bill and Wendy. A lot of developments in this case, this AJ Friend case. The boy has been missing. We are following it very, very closely in the newsroom, and we'll keep you up to date as new information becomes available. But we're trying to sort out the merits of listening to the 911 tapes. Just us, just the public, should we have access to those tapes? What are we getting out of those tapes? We're at 312-981-7200.
Jacob's on the line. Hey, Jacob.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you think?
I actually don't see any problem listening to the 911 tapes. I mean, us as human beings, I think we judge everything on a daily basis, regardless. So I really don't see any issue of listening to this and getting more information about the story.
You heard the tapes prior to, I guess they were released yesterday. Did you hear them yesterday or today?
I heard them yesterday, yeah.
And I've been
following the story, and I was actually glad that I got to hear the 911 tapes.
Did you make any conclusions, Jacob, based on what you heard?
Yeah, I felt like that, like the father, he did seem very calm. He seemed too calm. I know I don't have any kids, but if I had kids, I would be freaking out.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think we should be worried about judging this person. You know, we do it on a daily basis when we read People magazine.
What if it turns out that he had nothing to do with it? Wouldn't you feel kind of guilty for judging him?
Yeah, but I mean that's a natural emotion that I think you feel on a daily basis also about other things. You know, cutting in front of people in line, stuff like that.
You do that?
No, I don't. But if I did, I would feel guilty.
Yeah.
But I'd get over it, you know?
I know people have to listen to the 911 tapes, and I know that authorities should be listening to it. If it's there, I'm going to listen to it. It's like a car accident. You look at it. If it's there, I get it.
Yeah.
Jacob,
yeah.
Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Wendy, a couple of texters have suggested that these tapes were released in an effort to get one or both of the parents to confess. I'm not sure I understand the reasoning in that. I'm trying to put a line together to figure out how that would coerce one or both of the parents to confess, and I can't come up with it.
I think they were released after a Freedom of Information request.
That makes
more
sense.
From the media.
That makes a lot more sense. Yeah. Here's a text from 630. Someone's voice doesn't necessarily always mean that their state of mind is what you think. For example, when I was in college and the American Airlines DC-10 crashed on takeoff, the news played a front cockpit recording. The pilot was very calm, and the last words were heard were very monotone and deadpan. I remember
that. Yes.
Everybody's different under those circumstances. I get that.
I do have some other questions, and I'm sure they will all be answered, hopefully, during the press conference today. DCFS had issues with this family right when AJ was born. He was born with opiates in his system. He was taken away, I believe, for 18 months, returned to the family. They did do a check, and now it's being reported that there was feces and urine all over the house, and that there were some, the heat wasn't working, they were in disrepair. Repair.
Yeah.
Why was that child allowed to stay there when this was discovered? That's new information.
Sure.
I don't have answers to these questions.
And the volume of their appearances at the house was a very high number. You would think after a while there'd be some gigantic red flag that would come up saying maybe these parents aren't. I mean, it's easy to say that now with all that's going on, but
they did a check of the house and determined that some of these complaints were unwarranted. But then you hear reports now of feces and urine and deplorable situations.
Yeah,
wasn't that brought up when that DCFS worker came back and said, "Listen, this doesn't look right."
Right, right.
And I know the DCFS workers have a terrible job. I get it.
It's also a huge jump from living in conditions that are, as you described, horrible and suspecting that a parent could potentially take the life of one of their children. It's a big jump, thankfully.
There was a dog there. That's been removed.
Yeah.
At 12 noon, there will be a press conference, and we'll find out more information. Robert has called us, 312-981-7200. Hey, Roberto.
Robert's fine.
Hey there.
Thanks for taking my call. As far as the phone call or the 911 call, it doesn't help, you know, solve the case one way or another. But we're going to judge either way. Naturally, I got a 4-year-old myself, and I couldn't fathom the thought of my child just coming up and missing out of my home, first of all.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Everything's kind of, it's all a recipe to feel for us, you know, through the story that it definitely got something to do with it. I mean, this man just, in one video clip that I watched, he said he was getting up. You know, they were saying he was taking matters into his own hands. And they showed a video of him just walking out the house and just kind of walking out down the street going, I don't know where. He said he was going to follow some tracks or something. And the calmness of them is too much. It's just
Why do we need to know that, though? I mean, once it's determined if the parents had anything to do, we will certainly judge at that point, saying, how could that happen?
Sure.
But I don't know. I feel bad that we're aware of this information before the truth is out.
I guess, but, you know, it is public records, I guess. And one way or another, we're going to hear from it one way or another. And whether you judge it now or after, you're still going to make the judgment one way or the other. But I guess it's just a natural thing for us to do either way. I mean, you can listen to it and say, it didn't do nothing for me. you know, I heard him. Okay, nothing for me. But then you can watch a video for people can say, well, he's calm because he's this and that, watching an actual video versus some people can say, well, I would have lost it. I don't think I would be an actual walking zombie because they would have to drug me up so bad to stay calm, mm-hmm. you know, to know that my child is up and missing. But, I don't know. I think comparing to what the texter said about the flight that had crashed and the box that they had, you know, they were listening to. I think at that point, when you know you're dying, what choice do you have at that point? I mean, you have to put the information. I think pilots are trained to put that information out there. So if that ever was to occur, that information is out there.
I get and that.
If you're going down, there's nothing to panic about. I mean, you're going down. Stay calm.
Yeah.
Put the information out there and that's pretty much it at that point, I guess. But
Robert, we appreciate your thoughts on this.
Yeah.
Thanks, Robert. So much for calling. And real quickly here before we get to news, Scott, you have a thought?
Yeah. I mean, I can understand where a lot of people are coming from as far as, you know, he's too calm in the situation and what I would do. But on the same, on the opposite coin, if he was frantic, people would be saying, oh, he's too frantic. He was playing it off. He must be guilty.
There's something to that. There's definitely
right.
something to that.
And because everybody judges on both sides. I mean, I know how I would probably act in that situation because I am a single dad of two young children. But if unless I'm in that particular situation, I really don't know how. I know I would like to act, how I would think I would act.
But in the heat of the moment, you never know, right?
You never know how you're going to act. Maybe he was calm and he was innocent, you know, in the whole thing.
That's a great point.
But we don't know that.
Scott, thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
And Bill, you're so right. At that point, you know, perhaps he thought he just wandered away.
I think you're hoping for the best in a scenario like that. Of course, you're panicked to some degree because 1,000 times you've woke up and your kid is in his bed. But that one time, you're trying to hope for the best, I would imagine. I'm not coming to his defense. I'm just saying if it were me in that same circumstance with a child that age, I don't know how I would handle it. I would try my best to keep it together, but, you know, it's very unpredictable. All right, so more information, as we've pointed out, will be given throughout the day, and a press conference, as of now, is sponsored for 12 o'clock. We'll run that. You and I will be on the stream, but we will run it on the stream. Hopefully more answers will come out then. Steve, thanks very much. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. Mark Caro returns to the show. Mark, longtime columnist for the Chicago Tribune.
Hey.
And now retired, but working harder and longer than ever.
Yeah, not retired. Just is that doing different stuff.
Is that a bad word?
Well, I'm not that old. I don't know. I think of
that
retired.
That does make you sound old.
Either you've made a lot of money or you're just older than I am. But if you're a journalist and you're my age, you're not retired.
Oh, all right. That's fair. But the part that I know I got right is you're working harder than ever before. There's a new book out. What a book this is, by the way. Behind the Laughter, A Comedian's Tale of Tragedy and Hope. That tells the story of a guy that I know very well. I used to do stand-up comedy with Anthony Griffith for years and years and years. How did you get involved in his story? What happened?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'd been, you know, working on trying to get some different book projects going, as well as I've been doing some, you know, magazine articles for Chicago Magazine and some other, you know, stuff. And I'd just been in touch with the agents at William Morris in New York. And so Anthony has you. So you know Anthony because Anthony was a South Side comedian, and there's a whole sort of interesting actually comedy world story about him too, because he was like, you know, a 6 foot tall African American comedian who did not swear,
mm-hmm.
and so he was kind of like straddling, you know, like he'd be in the black clubs and the white clubs and all of this stuff, and he moved to L.A. and he was on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson 3 times in like 1990, 91. And while this was going on, his 2-year-old daughter was dying of cancer.
Yeah.
And years later, he did a monologue for The Moth, in which he talked about basically the producers prodding him, you have to be funny, while he was going through just the most, you know, severe hell that any parent could go through.
Yeah.
And he didn't tell the producers or anyone what was going on. He's a very quiet guy. I mean, he's a stand-up comedian, but he, you know, a lot of comedians, as you know, are kind of introverted. Mm-hmm. He wasn't telling people his business. But he did this Moth monologue in which he just sort of, it was like the sort of cathartic thing where he just talked about how horrible this was to go through and trying to be funny and do your job while you're also, you know, your daughter is basically dying. And this moth, this was like done in 2003. It didn't go onto YouTube till years later because YouTube wasn't invented. Now it's gotten over 2 million hits. And Ari Emanuel's son actually saw this and was like, Dad, who runs, you know, Ari Emanuel, who's Rahm Emanuel's brother and runs William Morris Endeavor, so he's like considered one of the most powerful men in Hollywood, decided he wanted to make a movie about this guy's life and talk to the people at William Morris in New York about, we need a book about this guy that we could base the movie on. And they knew me because I'd been talking to them, and she was actually the agent of another friend of mine in Chicago, and James Finn Garner, whose books are awesome, by the way, and wrote Politically Correct Bedtime Stories. And might as well throw in a plug for my friend Jim. So they talked to me. This is a Chicago guy, and you're a writer, and maybe you guys could talk and see how it would work out.
Yeah.
And so I talked to him, and he's just, you know him. Anthony's a wonderful guy.
One of the nicest guys in the world.
And he's been through so much, and yet he has the most positive attitude. And just talking to him is kind of inspirational and uplifting because he's just funny. He's still doing stand-up. He was diagnosed with MS like 25 years ago, so he's got a lot of challenges with that too. And he just presses on. And I thought, this was pitched to me the week after the inauguration of our current president. Because at first I thought, oh, this is a story about someone with a dying child, and I have children, and that's just so hard to deal with, and it's so loaded. But then I thought, the idea of how do you go to work and do your job when you feel like the world is falling apart is actually sort of a universal thing that, even if you haven't gone through this specifically, we all sort of struggle with that sometimes. How do you just do your job when you feel like your world is falling apart?
And when your mind is elsewhere.
Yeah. And his job is to be funny when he's feeling completely unfunny. And I encourage anyone who's listening to Google Anthony Griffith and The Moth and check out this monologue he did, because it's really powerful.
Try to get through it without crying.
Oh,
I dare you.
It's
impossible.
And it's one of those things where they would play it on the Moth Radio Hour, and people would, it was your literal pulled over on the side of the road thing, and people would call up and say, you know, Anthony, I was, Tony, you know, his friends call him, I was, you know, I had to pull over because he made me cry, especially the guys.
Yeah.
I have to admit, I had not heard of him. I looked him up. He looks familiar to me. Has he been still working?
He's still been working, and part of the story here, you know, part of the story is this dealing with this, you know, grief and everything else. Part of it is, you know, about his marriage, because he's been married to the same woman, Brigetta Travis Griffin, for over 30 years, and they never had another child. And this is like really hard stuff for a couple to go through. It's hard to stay married for 30 years regardless. But, you know, as he continued in his career, he'd gone through this, and he sort of tried to, and it affected his comedy, because His comedy used to be sort of about his life, but once he went through this with his daughter, he didn't want to bring that all on stage. And so the comedy became a little bit less personal. And then when he was diagnosed with MS, he was just kind of slowing down a little bit, but he didn't want to tell the producers about that either. So Hollywood didn't know. And so it kind of curtailed his career a little bit. So, you know, if you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm, he's on one of the episodes there where he's a repair guy who Larry David is firing, and Anthony's like, you think I'm black? It's because I'm black, right? He's funny. I mean, he did various shows. He's on, you know, the second Charlie's Angels movie. He was good friends with Bernie Mac, and actually would tour with Bernie Mac because he would be sort of the clean guy opening, and then Bernie Mac would come out and say, church is over, mother, and then something else.
Yeah.
So he had a career and still has a career, but it definitely sort of had to take a slower track after all he went through.
I have to say, as a guy who I worked with him a bunch of times, I still remember the very first time I saw him. You don't get jaded when you do stand up, but you kind of see it all. You see guys that do different kinds of things, and you just get used to it. And from the very first time I saw him, I just went, he's playing on a different field than the rest of us are. He was just so good, so quick. The way he didn't just tell jokes, they were stories that were filled with funny moments.
Right.
And boy, was he good at it. Just so good at it.
Yeah, it was personal, observational stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you know, when the whole Def Comedy Jam happened, I mean, he was never on it because he just wasn't working in that mode. He was working in this, you know, mode of just telling funny stories, and he's a funny guy, and you watch those young clips of him, he's this tall, good-looking guy, and he's got this sort of rat-a-tat delivery. You know, now he's got this sort of you know, because he's physically slowed down and just gotten older, as we all have. It's more of sort of a droll sort of delivery, but those early ones, and you could see some of the Carson stuff. And I think if you go on the website for the book as well, if you Google behind the laughter, Anthony Griffith, I think you'll get they have some clips up there, but if you go on YouTube, you can find him. And if you can find the older stuff, it's really fascinating. I think one of those Tonight shows is on there, because there were three with him, with Johnny Carson.
You know, other comics, I'm sure you know this, Mark. I don't know how you couldn't know this doing any research for the book. Other comics have told similar stories where they are given some bad news. Was it Bud Costello's? It was Costello's son, Lou Costello, not Bud Costello. Lou Costello's son, who had drowned prior to a show one time.
Wow.
And they told him, you can't go on stage tonight after this. And he goes, oh, no, I'm going on. And he had, like, the best show of his life. Other comics have told similar stories. I don't know what happens. I don't know what gear you kick into when something like that happens, but it's amazing that somebody can get through it, much less do it well.
Well, when Anthony was planning the second of his three Tonight Show appearances, it was really when the health of his daughter had gone downhill a lot, and his material had gotten much darker.
Yeah.
And the producer was like, this is kind of dark. And, you know, and it's funny, because, like, what we consider dark now is this stuff is nothing. You know,
right.
He was telling me what the jokes were, and I'm just like, really? That's not so bad. You know, there
right.
was one about, you know, killing your wife and putting her in the trunk of a car. But that sort of thing is just sort of standard at this point. But at the same time, you know, then it was really like, no, you have to balance that. And it wasn't a time when you would go on there. Like now, if someone was going through this now, it would be known. It would be on social media.
Sure.
It would be on YouTube, and the backstory would be known, and you know, he would probably be very famous just for having gone through this. But at the time, there was no social media other than your friends and your relatives, and they had a close-knit group. I mean, they were not telling people out in Hollywood. They felt like outsiders in Hollywood because they just moved there from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just sort of went through this on their own, and it really wasn't until this Moth monologue where people thought, oh, that's what was going on with him. And even that, he didn't talk about the MS until like a couple of years later.
I'll tell you, within the stand-up community here in Chicago, when he was living here, even we didn't know quite what was going on. There were whispers of what was going on, and nobody really knew for sure how bad it was. But the amazing thing is the way he got through it, the way he dealt with it, because a lot of people wouldn't be able to.
Yeah, no, he's still he's an incredibly positive guy. I mean, I wish him nothing but the best. I hope this movie gets made. I hope people know about him, because, you know, he's one of these guys who just gets up and he does the work, and it doesn't matter how hard it is. It's just what he does. And, you know, a lot of people do this stuff because they think they're getting fame and fortune, and he just did it because this is what he does, and he's really good at it.
Yep.
I cannot wait to read this, first of all, to find out more about him.
Mm-hmm.
I should know of him, and to also learn about how the show must go on in the face of adversity. I think it really appeals to a lot of people. I can't wait to read it.
Thank you. Yeah, that was why I got on it, because it wasn't something that I was initially thinking, oh, yeah, this is right in my wheelhouse. But that sort of the showbiz aspect of it, and also just the, I was inspired by him. And he's a really, you know, working with people who you like is a lot better than working with people who you don't like. And I really like him a lot. So
Mark Caro's book is called Behind the Laughter, A Comedian's Tale of Tragedy and Hope. You wrote it with Anthony Griffith and with his wife, Brigitta. Right?
Brigitta, yeah. She's amazing, too, by the way.
We'll find out more right after this. Stick around. It's Bill Leff, and it's Wendy Snyder on WGN.
Would you welcome Anthony Griffith?
Thank you very much. Glad to be back here in California. I just came back from Chicago, my birthplace, and I didn't plan on going to Chicago. I was offered to perform on a cruise ship, which I immediately declined, of course. I don't know everything about my African culture, but I know enough to ensure you the last thing I want to do in life is go on a long boat ride. I think the last brother that did that had to change his name to Toby. You know?
I told Wendy one of his jokes that I think is one of the best written jokes of all time. Talks about how it's when Ed DeBevics was still a restaurant here in Chicago.
Right.
And he said, I love eating at Ed DeBevics. It's so realistic. It's just like the 50s. Whenever I go there, they make me eat in the kitchen. So funny. So funny. The book is called Behind the Laughter, A Comedian's Tale of Tragedy and Hope. It's written about the comedian Anthony Griffith, still working today. The first time you met him, what was your impression of him?
I thought that he was just, you know, I talked to him on the phone a few times, and I went out to L.A., and I talked to him. And, you know, the book is, it's his book and Brigetta. Like, it's in their voices, and, mm-hmm. you know, I just kind of smoothed it out and, you know, helped it be, you know, become a book as someone who's written, you know, book before. I just thought that he was really nice, really open, you know, not just not guarded, not cynical. You know, he's someone who's lived in L.A. for a long time, and people who've been in L.A. for a long time can really get this kind of edge to them, like they don't trust people. And again, he has been through a lot. You just sort of lay this all out, and he's like, you know, he lost his daughter, and he was diagnosed with MS, and, you know, they never had another kid, which, you know, for a while they were hoping, you know, maybe they would adopt or something, and just all this stuff that he went through, and just the career setbacks, and, you know, obviously you go out to LA because you think you're going to become, you know, the next whatever it is, Richard Pryor who doesn't swear or something like that. And instead, you just end up having a career and you end up having a life. And he just, you know, he's just a trusting, funny guy, never lost a sense of humor and, you know, kept his faith, which is an important part of his story, too. And so I just was really impressed by him.
You know what he says, and I'm sure he relayed this to you at some point in the book. He talks about applause breaks. So for people who don't know, I'll simplify this as much as I can, but I think it's obvious. When you're doing stand-up, especially on The Tonight Show, and the audience likes a joke or a bit so right. much that they're applauding, and you have to stop and let the applause die down a little bit. Sometimes, if you're good, you might get one or two. He was just lining them up. He did these three appearances on The Tonight Show, and I think he had a total of 16 or 17 within the three appearances.
Yeah, like six or seven each time. And,
yeah.
And the first time he was on, you know, the comedian also, they're always kind of looking over because they want to get beckoned over to the couch.
Yeah.
Sure.
And he did not get beckoned over to the couch, but after he was on the first time, he runs into Johnny Carson in the parking lot,
yeah.
and Johnny comes up to him and says, look, I just want to tell you, you were really funny, and I'm going to get the producer to book you again, because I really want you back. And it was just this, you know, meeting of, you know, the legend in the parking lot of this guy who's come from, you know, I mean, he lived on the projects in the West Side, then lived on the South Side. He was going to school in Hyde Park, which, you know, which was not actually that close to where he lived, but that was sort of where the better schools were. And his yeah. mom went through a lot to give him this good life. And now he's got Johnny Carson saying, you're funny and I want you back. And, you know, as a comedian, you just want that validation so badly.
Sure.
And he was able to get that. And that's wonderful. And then he went home. And watch the show with him, his wife, and his sick daughter, and you know, it's like you're still in those two worlds. You know, you still got all that reality to deal with.
He even says at some point, all those applause breaks, I would trade them in a minute for
right.
another minute with my daughter.
Right?
Isn't that something?
Well, you know, and anyone who's lost someone who's close to them, you would, you know, at some point you would sort of trade everything for another
sure.
minute with them. And I think we all relate to that. I mean, anyone who's gone through any sort of loss. But this is, you know, losing a child is
unimaginable.
Know, that's just, yeah, that's just the most heartbreaking of them all. And it was, you know, it just was a tough time for
them.
Was
he ever tempted to quit, Mark? Did he ever say, this is just too much for me? Or did that not even enter into it?
I think he didn't really, because I think this is just what he wanted to do. And I think that his wife sometimes was like, hey, you know what? You know, the universe is sending you a signal. Maybe you ought to get a job. And he's like, no, this is my job. This is my gift. This is my talent. This is what I do.
Yeah.
And he's been able to keep working. And her story is pretty incredible too, because she went back to school and became a child psychologist. And so she's actually surrounded by kids all the time, trying to sort of counsel them and get them through difficult childhoods. And so he teaches, you know, kids at Sunday school. She does child therapy for a living. And so they've surrounded themselves to sort of give back to children, even though, you know, even after they've gone through this with their own.
Yeah.
What a beautiful couple. I mean,
yeah, they're
seriously.
Amazing. No, they're really amazing. And it's funny too, because she's kind of cynical and, you know, nothing's going to get past her. And she says that, you know, he's kind of Pollyannish, and they just balance each other really nicely. They take care of each other. And, you know, you just look at this and you're like, this is like a really cool marriage, and this is how it's supposed to work, even when, you know, good times and bad.
Mark, he was a stand-up primarily. He was starting to get acting roles. You mentioned Curb Your Enthusiasm and some other comedic roles. But I remember he was, did he play Eldridge Cleaver?
He played Eldridge Cleaver in the Mario Van Peebles movie Panther. And yeah, that was, there were two movies, I think it was 1995, and he actually had his sort of film breakthrough then. He was in Panther, which didn't, I think they thought was going to do a lot better than it did. I saw that movie when it came out, but yeah, he's Eldridge Cleaver and he's very good in it, and mm-hmm, he's swearing, which he does not do in real life, and he had to sort of like, look, I'm playing a character. He's kind of mean in it. I mean, this is a hard-edged guy, which is completely the opposite of him. And then he was also in another movie that actually is the one that I think probably got him the most recognition, which is Tales from the Hood. Mm-hmm. And it's this anthology of these horror stories, and he's in, I think it's the first one, there's a guy who's a black guy who's basically killed by these white cops, and Anthony plays this other cop who's sort of watched this going on and is haunted, and anyway, he's very good in that as well. But
you know who else is in that? Clarence Williams III.
He is
from Mod Squad.
He is.
Tales from the Hood. Yep.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's not a movie that made $100 million, but it was a pretty big cult hit, and you know, people still come up to him and talk to him about Tales from the Hood.
So their hope is that this will become a movie. Have you talked to him about who would play him if it does become a movie?
Well, I don't think he gets any choice. I think that, you hear standard names thrown around. I mean, someone like Jamie Foxx is thrown out. Anthony's a lot taller than Jamie Foxx. Yeah. We'll see. I mean, it's interesting because I think about like, well, who would I cast as him? Mahershala Ali, he could play anyone. He's a tall guy. He's good.
Tyler Perry.
Tyler Perry.
He's tall, isn't he?
He could play every member of the family. And it depends too. Also, the other thing is that the story spans a while because you have him in sort of his late 20s, early 30s at the beginning. And then, now, he's in his, mid 50s. So are you... Do you cast someone who's like somewhere in between age wise? You cast someone young, and I don't know. These questions are beyond my pay grade.
Of course,
but I would love to see that happen for sure.
The book is excellent. It's Behind the Laughter, A Comedian's Tale of Tragedy and Hope. It tells the story of a Chicago comic, Anthony Griffith, and what he was going through when his career was at its absolute best. His life was just the opposite. So
right, and a lot parallel about Chicago in there too. About before they left here, a lot about the Chicago comedy scene. So there's a lot that, a lot of stuff you're familiar with.
Oh, excellent.
As well.
And please, you can find it everywhere. I looked online. This was just released on April 9th, so this is fresh.
Yeah, it's just out.
You can find it at Target, at Barnes & Noble, at Amazon.
I got
Amazon.
It at Shake Shack.
That's weird. They should have a Shake Shack.
They had a Shake Shack.
What a great idea. A book and a burger.
Perfect lunch.
Awesome.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Keep up the great work.
Wonderful.
Tell Anthony
to be with
we
you
said
guys.
Hello.
I absolutely will.
That's Mark Caro.
Yeah, and we'll try to get him back in Chicago soon, too.
Excellent.
Please do.
Yeah, we would love that.
I hope the book does great, and then the movie gets made, and he just keeps working and getting stronger.
Me, too.
Sounds
absolutely
like he deserves it.
Perfect
absolutely
ending.
He does. Thank you.
Coming up, the stories that matter with Steve Bertrand from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN Radio. Steve, thanks very much. Dane Neal joins us right now by way of the telephone. Dane is, like his show title, on the road right now. Where are you, Dane?
What, are you on tour with Guns N' Roses?
Oh, I wish. I wish get back to the old Guns N' Roses, the old tour days. Yeah. No, well, I don't know. Depending on what your definition of excitement is. We're doing the family road trip, so the on-the-road family road trip. And Bill and Wendy, you know that it's important to, to work, walk the walk, to be the brand,
yes,
right? And people just are disappointed. The letters, and calls come flooding in when I'm not out on the road.
Yes, you need to be. By virtue of your title, you need to be on the road at all times.
That's so much pressure.
Do
right?
you want to say mobile. Where you're going on this road trip, or is that top secret?
Oh, no, it isn't top secret. In fact, it's an inspiration to others to follow in my broken, not broken, but sprained ankle footsteps. But
yes.
So we went to do one of the ones that people typically do, somewhere in the Orlando area. There's a lot of things, out there. The bat signal for family fun is up in the sky. And, so it's building in a little bit of the food stuff too. We wanted to come down to Orlando, seeing Disney and Legoland and the Epcot World Showcase. But I did have a cautionary tale for the people that do the road trip on the way down.
What's
have you
that?
Guys ever done that where you stop kind of halfway, sort of in like the Chattanooga area?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, so I went to the. Did you go to the Chattanooga Choo Choo for lunch?
Yes, you have to.
We've done Ruby Falls. We've done the Falls, or Ruby Falls, and that's where I discovered one of the times it was reinforced that I'm claustrophobic.
Oh.
Right, which isn't a good time when you're under a mountain, in a tunnel there. But no, so we stopped just to kind of like you know, spend the night, kind of recharge, and then get going the next day. And we walked into the hotel. It was a motel. It was a relatively major brand, so it wasn't just like, you know, Larry's Motel. It was, you know, something that you've heard of.
Yeah.
But the kind where you can access the rooms from the outside, and so you sort of pull up to the area where you're going to be staying. And we walked in, and Esther said, oh, the TV was on when we walked in. Didn't think anything of it, but it smelled like smoke. You know, it smelled like smoke. And so we ordered a non-smoking room, and you know that they'll charge you. If you get crazy, go rogue, you know, and smoke in the room. So we called in and said, hey, it isn't us. And they noted it. And the next day, Esther had run into someone in the ice room that smelled a lot like smoke. It was a younger couple, and went to the front desk just to reinforce. And he said, oh yeah, the last month or so, a lot of these people who buy non-smoking rooms are smoking in the room, and they're charging them. Uh-huh. So we don't charge you. We'll charge the previous guy. But it turned out that they were just kind of sneaking in and hanging out in the rooms. Crazy.
What? You can't get rid of that smell
no,
either. When you walk
good.
Into a hotel room, oh my God.
Well, I don't know that, Wendy, that it was really that they were actually smoking in the room. I think they just, because it didn't really smell like someone had been smoking, like, right at that minute. It wasn't actual smoke. It smelled like a smoking hotel room, you know, the kind of thing that just kind of lingers around. So I think it was just sort of them, and they had just left, and I think that was kind of their deal.
Oh, on their person, yeah.
Yeah, they had, a card from one of the maids or something, and so what they were able to do is kind of sneak in, hang out for a few hours, and then kind of duck out. But a lot of people were getting charged for it, because the hotel guy said, well, we'll just charge the last guy. And I'm like, he didn't do it either.
Dane, I know it's not my place to tell you this, but I know for a fact one of your daughters smokes cigars.
I knew you were going to say that.
I've seen her do it.
You know what, I come into Vivian's room, yeah. You know, and she's like, hey, nothing.
Yeah.
Dad, you know, and
you got Tipperillo wrappers all over the bed. That's awful. That's horrible. Why the decision, Dane? I know that you like being out on the open road, but why the decision to drive to Florida instead of fly? You could fly there in 2.5 hours. Why drive?
Well, you wouldn't experience a lot of the kind of local situations and some of these funny stories, like, you know, the whole, you know, being charged for smoking in the room.
Sure.
Well, I think it's fun. You get out there, you see a little bit of America, you have conversations with kids, like, yeah, maps aren't just a, you know, they thought that the map, they saw one in a gas station, was actually just a picture, like it was art. You know, they didn't understand,
right.
But it had a real purpose. And plus, too, just with, you know, we've got a car with decent gas mileage, and it's so expensive to fly. You got five people, you know, it's really expensive.
Quick. The one difference between when we were kids and kids today is we really didn't have too many options. You know, now a kid could have a video game with them or watch a movie during a car trip. It makes it go by nice and fast, doesn't it?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, they all have their own independent and individual kind of entertainment
situations. Lifesaver.
To whatever. But right, remember where we were relegated
fighting.
To staring out the window, seeing other makes and models of cars and then punching each
yes.
other.
Yes.
License plate bingo, everyone.
That's all you did. Our only entertainment, Dane, was my brother Adam would sing Kiss songs all the way to Florida. That was fun.
I would have liked to travel with you guys.
Well, there's so many albums. If you go to like either Destroyer or Rock and Roll, there's some hidden gems there.
Yeah, that's true.
How did Beth sound?
That one actually sounded good, Wendy. I have to say, of his entire repertoire, Beth was the one that my parents would go, do Beth one more time.
We do that twice, right? It's like, all right, who wants to hear it again?
Yes, and then, yes. That was the encore.
You know what I always remember is just battling car sickness the whole time. And I don't know if that's a thing of the past, just like measles, mumps, or, you know, maybe the plague, but it doesn't seem like people are getting as sick, because it was always a situation in whatever long road trip. Like, you always feel like, I feel sick. I don't know what it is.
That was me. My family had to pull over all the time.
Mm. Never
just,
pleasant.
You know what it is, I found out? You have to eat a little something, because if you have an empty stomach, that makes you feel that way.
No, that's true.
And keep the windows down.
Yeah. Yeah.
You need the fresh air.
Yep. Dane, I need your opinion on this. When I was a kid and we would go to Florida every other year, we would drive. Like, one year we would drive, then we'd fly. We alternated every year. So when we would drive, my parents kind of insisted, more times than not, that whenever we would stop somewhere for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, it was a local eatery. It wasn't a chain. I think that's better. You get more of the flavor of wherever you're traveling to, right?
Right, wrong, good, bad, or indifferent. You're going to get to taste a little bit of that local stuff. And from the selection side, you know, if you go to an Applebee's or Chili's, you know, it's going to be the same thing here as it is in Topeka, Kansas. So you're going to want to try to test some of that stuff out. Now, unlike when, let's say, we were kids, Bill, is that you have the opportunity to find out which ones are good or bad, as opposed to it being the complete, you know, culinary Russian roulette, right? Yeah. Where you just walk in, you have no idea, you know, that there's, you know, it's got zero stars and everyone in the local area is afraid of it. So this way you can kind of get, you know, some recommendations for people who've been there before. I think it's great.
My mom would also keep a journal that kept a rating system on all the bathrooms between here and Florida.
Is that
you know,
true?
Had yeah. she published
there is an
that,
app for that now,
she could have made a lot of money.
She could have been a billionaire.
Yeah.
Because she would always consult. She'd say, where are we? And my dad would say, we're in Macon, Georgia. And she would go, the Big Boy, the restrooms at Big Boy get 3.5 stars. So then we would go to Big Boy just for the bathrooms.
They do a really nice job.
Well, yeah.
You hit the truck stops on the way down. And again, like this is, you know, the kids are wide-eyed in amazement and, you know, just kind of taking in the American situation. And so at the truck stops, while we're sitting there, you know, just chopping, I guess, right? You know, getting some snacks and things like that. Over the loudspeaker, it's like, showers ready for number four.
Oh.
You know, and so they're wondering what's going on, because a lot of the truck stop situation, the truckers, you know, they'll get in there and then they have different showers and they get
sure.
the reservation like anything else.
Are you kidding me? I never
knew
true. This.
That's true.
Yeah. It's like showers, right? But they have the, you know, they can't just let anybody do it. It just can't be, you know, Brad, the guy who happens to work there, saying, hey, showers ready. So they've got it, you know, the finer establishments, the ones that are well-appointed, they have a voiceover person be like, showers ready at number four. You know,
Wendy looks shocked, but it's true.
You know, I know taking a number at the deli counter, is that kind of what this is like? You take a number
exactly
and then when
like
call,
it
calls, really?
That's it, exactly.
Like I'll have a pastrami, a ham,
I'll
have sour with extra conditioner, you know, or whatever.
When you were gone a couple of weeks ago, I told the story about how on a trip like that, we stopped at a truck stop, and the big sign said, free shower with minimum fill. And I asked my parents who this minimum fill guy was, and why would you want to shower with him? I feel dirty.
Just like your mom had a journal of great places to, or at least clean places to go to the bathroom, I'm sure, you know, Minimum Fill probably has some fans out there, too.
Oh, yeah.
Probably a website dedicated to
oh,
it.
Oh, without a doubt,
the
Dane.
Few times we did drive to Florida, I think twice in my life, we were just all women, so we never stopped at a truck stop. We were at the Stuckey's and at the Lums.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sometimes late at night, that's your option, is a truck stop or no gasoline at all. So,
well, and even the reason I brought up the truck stop stuff is that typically the family bathroom is the one to go in. So I had to take Viv, had to go to the bathroom. She doesn't have much of a lead time, and she's got a very short fuse on the, hey, I have to go, to, hey, I just went. You know, it's
yeah.
really quick. So
yeah.
you don't have that whole, hey, can you hold it for another 10 miles? So I had to run in with her. You know, and so they had a family bathroom. Typically, the family bathrooms are relatively, they're just, I don't know, cleaner and more accessible or whatever,
yeah.
and I was going to let her in there. So we opened the door and looked in, and it was just, I don't know what happened in there, but it
wasn't
was messy.
Good.
And then,
yep.
yeah, so she had to head out. So,
yep.
so you got to watch yourself out there on the road.
Good advice, Dane. Dane Neal is our guest. We'll continue this conversation in just a little bit. Stick around for that. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder. Our guest is Dane Neal. You can hear him here on weekends. You can hear him here right now. He's on with us right this minute. Dane, you're headed out toward Orlando. Is this to coincide with the Epcot International Food and Wine Festival?
Well, actually, there's always great food and wine going on at Epcot, as you know, and stuff from around the world. The festival itself is an extended kind of period of time, but it's a few months, and it's usually in the fall. It's the Epcot International Flower and Garden Festival is one of the things going on. I know Wendy's a big gardener.
Yeah.
She loves flowers. She's out there. And to see that, like, Disney is the kind of place in Epcot, they've got it dialed in so much that they're not necessarily worrying about making sure there's enough cotton candy for all the kids that the rides don't stop. You know, they can take 3 months and put, you know, millions and millions of flowers out there, sweep it all away on June 3rd. But the topiaries are, you know, are out there, and a lot of educational stuff as well. So if you're interested in Goofy, and who isn't, to see him like as a 14-foot, like arborvitae, is pretty impressive.
You know, in the early days of Disney World, they had these topiaries. These are plants that are shaped like various Disney figures or things like that. They were sprinkled all throughout the Magic Kingdom. If you were riding the monorail, you could look out and see them. And then for some reason, they took them all down except for this festival. What happened, Dane? Do you know?
I think it's probably contract negotiations, just like anything else. Is you know, with the merchandising and all that kind of stuff, and celebrities,
the topiaries wanted more money.
Yeah,
it get more difficult to deal with. Well, I found out, like I can't talk with Eric Darden, and we'll hear him on the show coming up. And he's been there the whole 26 years, and it did start out with just they call them the Fab Five. So these are, you know, there is like a totem pole of, or a hierarchy of status for the, obviously Mickey is the, you know, he's at the top, and then it goes down all the way to maybe like the third Bluebird from the left, and Cinderella is like, you know, kind of down the bottom. And so they started with those guys, and now they've got them featured, you know, all throughout the entire festival, and then they're also like building it into new movies that are coming out, like Toy Story 4. So you'll see like Woody and Buzz and Bo Peep and a bunch of different characters, plus all the ones you know and love up close. It's really amazing to see what they can do. It's pretty cool.
I do have to say, if you're a fan of various types of food, high-end, low-end, somewhere in the middle, no one does it better than Disney. There's something for everybody's taste, and there's incredible adventures to be had. Even if you're not a theme park goer normally, their food world is incredible as well. Don't you agree?
Have you ever had that conversation, Bill, with somebody who's kind of made the case, like honestly made the case that, like, hey, they don't need to travel because they went to Epcot?
Yeah.
So they did the whole world. You know, and they'll reference the fact that there are, you know, real either former residents or people who speak the languages, right, that are there, you know, working, you know, that there's to scale, but, right, buildings that reference the things that are going on there. And on the food side, they built a lot of that stuff in there as well. So you've got, you know, all those different, there's like 10 or 15 different countries that you can visit. And I don't know that they'll add new ones. You know, I think as a country maybe becomes more prominent, that would be something cool to suggest. But America is in there as well. And America is the only one, the United States is the only one that doesn't have like a sit-down restaurant.
Uh-huh.
And I was kind of curious about that. I mean, whether it's hey, you got to figure, even though you draw on people from around the world, a lot of people are from America, familiar with it, let's experience the world, don't spend a lot of time here. Or that maybe they don't think there's, you know, enough American food to warrant a restaurant, or that maybe because we're a melting pot, that it would always be sort of a spin or a takeoff on something else.
You know what became one of our favorite restaurants there? They have the Animal Kingdom Resort, and downstairs at that hotel, there's an African-themed restaurant. I knew nothing about African food whatsoever, but my family and I ate there once, and the food was so outrageously good. My wife asked, she goes, I know you're not supposed to give out recipes, but... And then she asked for this one particular, it was kind of a rice dish, but it was a peanut butter-based rice dish. I've never had anything like it before. They went out of their way. They sent us the recipe to our house.
Really?
Just unbelievable how accommodating they were. Really nice.
Oh, well, here, you know, on the food side of it, and this goes all the way from the beginning, and they are super, I tried to explain it to the kids, kind of like, you know, when Eleanor Divy went to the Taylor Swift concert, and I said, I've been to a lot of concerts, I've worked at a lot of concerts, you know, back on tour with Guns N' Roses.
Sure.
And this is as good as it gets. It's all downhill from here. You're never going to have a whole stadium filled with people and dragons and snakes and fire breathing, whatever. When it comes to Disney and the theme park side, every single detail, even and especially on the food side, it's just, they just kind of go, I don't want to say one level, they go like 10 levels higher. On the food side, Walt Disney, back when he started Disneyland, and Marcy Smothers wrote that book, Eat Like Walt, and it just came out, and I'll get you guys a copy of it too. He wanted the food side of it to be as much of an experience, at least a big part of it, as the rides and all the other attractions. It's always been front and center.
Yep. What are you looking forward to the most on this trip, Dane?
We're going to be checking out a bunch of different things, spending some time with family. One of the things is Dr. Barbecue, you know, is our good friend. He's opened up a restaurant in St. Petersburg that is just kind of setting the standard in a bunch of different ways on a barbecue site. So we're going to visit him tomorrow. We're actually going to check out Busch Gardens tomorrow. They've got the highest, I don't know if you guys are roller coaster people, but they was just released as the highest roller coaster in Florida.
Wow.
And it's Tigris, and it's like, I don't know, 20 stories high, and it's one of those things. I'm going to talk the kids into going, and then I'll ask them about it. I don't think I'll go myself.
Do they still give you Busch beer? I went as a kid to Busch Gardens, and they gave you a little sample of Busch beer that my mom actually let me drink at about, you know, 11 years old.
It's strange that you mention that one, because Bill had mentioned, you know, Vivian and her cigar-smoking habit, is that Vivian had asked about that. It's like, which different Busch beer selections may be available at the park.
You know, Auntie Wendy can teach her a few more things if you want.
That's a great idea.
And Dane, actually, if you're going to Disney, I may have you look for some Haunted Mansion wallpaper men's lounge pants. We had
you have a wedding coming up?
No, it's for my son, and we had a mishap, and we need to replace those. So I'm going to send you the link if you're in the gift store.
Okay, absolutely. Definitely send it. And it's the kind of thing, too, is those, and I remember going on those rides as kids. We make the kids, not me, but we explain to them it's important and they get to participate in it. And those rides, I don't know, it's so crazy because so much in the ride world is about, you know, bigger, better, faster, excitement. But there's a nostalgia and sort of that legacy of those rides is as great as they are, you know, whether it's Pirates of the Caribbean or Jungle Cruise or Haunted Mansion or even Space Mountain, right, where you can remember where you were when you went as a kid, and it's great to have your kids go, too.
Yep. It's so sad you're just missing the opening of their Star Wars area. You're just going to miss it by a couple months. That's unfortunate.
Yeah, but you had to make reservations, didn't you? So
yeah.
How does that work?
It's coming up. Yeah, well, Galaxy Edge is coming up on August 29th in Orlando. If you're, for those people that, you know, are really enthusiasts of the Star Wars world, Wendy, of course, you know this, you know, just having 2,000 miles apart isn't going to stop them, is coming up, I think it's very soon. You know, maybe it's in June or maybe even earlier, is out at Disneyland, and they're supposed to be the same. But you have to, in order to get on it, and it's going to be, I think it's Smuggler's Run is the only ride, or at least the first one to start, which is the Millennium Falcon ride, is that you have to actually stay at the hotel, have reservations at one of the properties in order to get on that ride, because they're anticipating, you know, waits of 5 hours plus.
God, I hope you're not listening, Jim.
I'll take Jim to Santa's Village. We'll have a good time. You won't make it.
That'd
be fun. You'll see.
All right, I'm texting you the Haunted Mansion wallpaper lounge pants and the size and everything for my son. So if you see them, I'll pay you back.
And Dane, I got a list of 14 relatives I need stuff for, so you'll get that in your email today. We appreciate it.
And you're on Saturday or you're not?
You know what? I don't know. I may be preempted by probably a very enthusiastic Dan Hampton, and there's a Bears draft special. Oh. So I got to figure out if we're going to be doing some stuff there. But I did want to mention very last thing at the Chicagoland Speedway Facebook page, the Ultimate Burger Battle. You can get all the information and sign up as part of the BBQ Smokedown at Chicagoland that I'm doing. So if you guys, Bill, I know you make a mean burger.
Yes.
You can get in on this.
Right.
Enter to win a $1,000 grill package, and it's going to be great.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you, Dane. Have a great rest of your trip.
Safe travels.
All right. Thanks, guys.
That's Dane Neal, ironically on the road, just like the title of his show.
Thank you, David. We appreciate it. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. And there is a special screening that is happening this weekend, Saturday, at the Gene Siskel Film Center. And it involves HBO's latest film, The Tale. On the line with us right now is internationally acclaimed producer, writer, cinematographer, director of The Tale. Jennifer Fox is with us. Jennifer, how are you?
I'm great. I hope I'm not in too noisy of an environment, but I'm great.
No, we are happy to have you. I have seen the trailer for The Tale that will be shown as a big event this weekend, Saturday, at the Gene Siskel Film Center. Now, this is based on your own life story, and Laura Dern plays you.
Yes. I'm very lucky to have such a beautiful, tall, blonde woman playing a short, dark, Jewish woman.
Also, some people involved. Common is in this. Ellen Burstyn, who's great. Jason Ritter plays a big role in this as well.
Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth Debicki. I mean, we have an incredible cast. So I'm blessed to have these people basically enacting a true story from my life.
We had talked to the people of PAXA and Parents Against Child Sex Abuse. This Leaving Neverland came out, the Michael Jackson documentary. And I have to be quite honest with you, Jennifer. When you think of sexual abuse, you think of force and things that are beyond your control. And my mind kind of opened up to a type of abuse where at the time you don't even know it's abuse, and that's what The Tale deals with.
Exactly. I mean, I think the notion that you just expressed is actually fairly false notion about child sexual abuse, and it's what makes it so difficult to deal with, both to see it happening and to stop it, and also to deal with the aftermath. Because child sexual abuse is about coercion and manipulation of an adult in a way that a child thinks that he or she is making choices. And so the child often doesn't know that anything bad is happening until it's too late for them to say no, because they have such an esteem for this adult. So it's really a huge manipulation that happens. It is like, in its impact, a different kind of diagram than rape. Even though we call it statutory rape, I hope I'm not being too technical.
No,
you're fine, Jennifer.
Yeah, and
I'll go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I think the tale, the film I made, is about an adult who Laura Dern plays, based on my story, looking back and realizing that something she thought was a relationship, which was the, quote, relationship I had with my 40-year-old track coach at 13 years old, was in fact not a relationship but abuse. And in my true life and in the film, you see, it took me till I was in my 40s to ever even name it as abuse, although anybody watching in 2 minutes will call it child sexual abuse. And that's exactly the kind of manipulation and almost brainwashing that often goes on with child sexual abuse.
Jennifer, was there a moment that you realized that this was abuse, or did it happen over a long span of time? What exactly took place that made you realize that what you thought was right was far from being right?
You know, I told myself a story, and the tale is very much about the stories we tell ourselves to trauma. But I believed that it was a relationship until I was making another film in my 40s about female life in the world. And every second or third woman had a story of sexual abuse, assault, or rape. And I was so shocked because the film was not about violence against women. And it made me reconsider the event that happened to me, because there's a kind of paradigm of abuse. And it's funny, a lot of child sexual abuse, if you look at the structure of it, is very similar. There's a what we call grooming. There's a period where the adult, you know, gives a lot of love and attention to the child, be it a girl or a boy, and makes them feel special and adored and loved, and incrementally crosses. Once that occurs, then slowly starts to cross boundaries. And the child is so confused because they think this is an adored adult that they can't say no. So that structure is something that happened to me, and you'll see it in the tale. But you'll also see that I thought at 13 that I was making choices, when in fact I had no idea what was going on.
Well, that's a coming of age thing, too, that you see in the movie, where a young Jenny wants to be in control of her own life and to be just enamored with the woman involved. I can't remember the character's name.
Mrs. G.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, but you look up to somebody and you think, wow, I want to be like this woman. She's offering everything to the world. I want to be just like her. And then these feelings turn into something else. It was so interesting to watch. And I was ignorant of the whole grooming thing. I never even heard of that before leaving Neverland.
Yes, I love Leaving Neverland, by the way. And together with the tale, I think it's really breaking people's misconceptions about child sexual abuse. Because I think the media has always presented it as this black and white. There's the predator who looks like a dark, evil man. And then there's the innocent child who is preyed upon. And yes, the child's innocent, but the predator can be anyone. He's often someone embedded in the community. And we say the predators groom the child, the family, and the community. And they're often people who are very highly regarded. And it's why an organization like PAXA, which is where we're screening the film at the Gene Siskel Center Saturday at 10 to 11 to 1, and I'm speaking, by the way.
Yes.
It's why it's so important that parents become awake to the fact that grooming happens to them too. Often predators are beloved by parents because the parents don't realize that they've been brainwashed as well. My coach was actually an Olympic athlete and an Olympic coach, celebrated by the community, you know, a real big shot, and everybody adored him. And that is a kind of typical predator.
Jennifer, was there anybody, while you were going through this, was there anybody, a family member, a friend, who looked at what was going on with your relationship? And I know they didn't know all the ins and outs, but they knew some of it and just went, this is inappropriate, we got to look into this, or did that just not happen?
Well, my situation, and forgive me for those listening, every event of sexual abuse is different, so I may be sounding like I'm making generalizations, and if I am, they're often wrong. But in my case, the sexual abuse, I was staying at my riding coach, who was a woman's house, on the weekends, away from my parents. So they didn't have contact with really either. They didn't know the running coach who was abusing me. They had never met him. They did, you know, they were putting their trust in this riding coach. So he came one day, and this is a scene in the film, to pick me up, and brought my mother flowers. And my mother was like, wait, what is this adult bringing me flowers for? It was like a triggering event. Like, that's what boyfriends do to the parents of the girl they're dating.
Yeah.
And my mom really, at that point, started to grill me. And I, being an adolescent, and this is the other trouble with sexual abuse in adolescence, I denied everything. She was like, what's that man doing? Who is he? Is he having an affair with your riding coach? What's going on? Like, she suspected something. I don't think she suspected abuse. Remember, it was 1973.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was an adolescent, and I was like, this is my life. Get out of my life. I didn't cop to it, and I lied through my teeth. So there was, both my parents, there was a growing suspicion of what was going on, but they didn't have the tools that I think parents can have now when they arm themselves to be aware. And again, that's why an organization like PACSA, which is Parents Against Child Sexual Abuse, is so important. And Tanya High and her husband David, who created it, they understand that parents need their eyes open to see the signs and respond appropriately. And I think that's why they wanted to host this screening. It's an opportunity to look at the film and then talk about how parents become armed and more aware through asking their children questions, maintaining rules about what's appropriate, and also, you know, not taking things at face value. Now, in my case, again, it was 1973. You have to understand, sexual abuse didn't happen in the nice, white, affluent Jewish suburbs.
Yeah.
My parents just had no expectation of that. And in fact, even at school, which meant been trained much more than they were then, I handed in a story that the tale, the film is based on, my English class, and I got an A for it. And the story was a very thinly veiled story about what happened to me with these two adults. Of course, it didn't say sex, but it, you know, the teacher was alarmed enough to say, if this is true, it's a travesty, but since you're so well adjusted, it can't be true. And there was an A on my paper.
And you hid that from your mother, because at one point, that's where Ellen Burstyn, playing your mother, decides to contact you and wants to talk to you, which starts the story moving. There's another moment that I thought was pretty fascinating, as Laura Dern, playing the part of you, Jennifer Fox, is looking back at some of the other kids that were at this riding camp, and she sees what they look like now, and there's a moment like you live with them in your head happily, never wanting anything to change. You just go back to that time when things were wonderful.
Yes. Now, this is the complication, again, of child sexual abuse and everything in memory, is that there was good and bad. And so what I remembered the way I survived the event is I remembered the good. I remembered the attention. I remembered how much I adored them. I remembered that they made me feel special.
Jennifer, we have to interrupt. We have some breaking news. We are going to take a quick break. We'll come back and continue with Jennifer Fox, but we go live to the newsroom right now.
Thank you very much. We are getting multiple reports now that authorities are saying off the record that the body of 5-year-old Andrew Friend has been found. There's been no official statement from police yet, but the word has made its way to multiple sources, including Channel 9 and the Chicago Tribune, that the young boy is no longer missing and that they have found his body. Now, they will be holding a news conference at 1 p.m. We will carry it live here on air and also on our stream at WGNradio.com. But again, multiple reports. 5-year-old Andrew Friend, the young boy missing in Crystal Lake since last week, no longer missing. His body found today on land in unincorporated Woodstock. Wendy?
Thank you very much, David. That is sad news indeed. We're going to take a break, and we'll continue talking about HBO's The Tale. They're teaming up with PAXA this Saturday, Parents Against Child Sex Abuse, and there'll be a movie screening and a Q&A with director Jennifer Fox, who we will continue talking with next here on 720 WGN. All right, we are talking to Jennifer Fox, the writer, director, cinematographer. You've done everything on The Tale. It's HBO's latest film, and a special screening this Saturday, April 27th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., a panel discussion and Q&A with director Jennifer Fox following the film. It's all taking place at the Gene Siskel Film Center, 164 North State Street in Chicago. Registration is required. You can go to eventbrite.com, and PAXA will be there as well, Parents Against Child Sex Abuse. An amazing film. I loved it. I was touched by it. I was horrified by it, but it gets people talking. So great job to you, Jennifer.
Well, thank you so much.
Jennifer, sadly, so many times when we hear stories of child sexual abuse, those kids go on to say that later in life, they have a very difficult time maintaining any kind of relationship with somebody else. I know this is a personal question, but do you fit that category? How did it play out for you?
You know, I think that for me, it became kind of a holy grail that I was going to work on my ability to have relationships and to love and to be sexual. And so it's been a path I've been on. I guess I've been in relationship all my life, and I'm married, and I've been with the same man for 17 years. Not to say that marriage or heterosexuality is good, but I think I've been fighting that fight. It does impair your ability to trust. It damages it, because whether I like it or not, this person or people, in my case, that I trusted so profoundly at age 13, totally abused that trust and manipulated me in a very kind of intimate way that leaves a scar. What I want to say, though, is that as horrible as it is, child sexual abuse, we have to give children and arm them who have been hurt with strength to carry on, because nobody gets through life without trauma. And so rather than say, you know, this is the pathology of my life, this is the challenge of my life, we have to arm children and parents to teach children to be resilient and to survive. I hope that doesn't sound too Pollyanna-ish,
no,
but I want to be realistic here.
Yeah.
Like, have you, either of you, gotten through your life without trauma?
There's trauma everywhere. It's impossible.
Yes, but fortunately, when you start comparing traumas, then all of a sudden, Jennifer, and I didn't have it so bad. That's what you find me saying.
But you would hear me say that, too, because I feel like my sexual abuse was sexual abuse light. And if you say that to somebody, they'll go, oh, my God, how could you say that? But it could be much worse. So the reality is life is full of trauma, and we have to both face that, but we also have to arm people with resilience, and that's the most important thing. And I think one of the messages of The Tale is that, you know, I am a survivor, and a lot of people who have been abused are survivors. You wouldn't even recognize that they have child sexual abuse in their past. So we want to give people that capacity to get over and not just pity them and make them into victims.
That is a great takeaway from this. Jennifer, it was a pleasure talking to you. Congrats and continued success. The Tale. PAXA presents HBO's The Tale. It's a screening this Saturday, Gene Siskel Film Center. You can go to eventbrite.com. And I also want to give PAXA's website as well. It's PAXA.online, Parents Against Child Sex Abuse. Jennifer, we look forward to talking to you again.
Oh, thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks, Jennifer. All right, a quick break, and then we'll turn things over. Wendy and I are headed toward the stream. You can join us there or stick around and listen to Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Lunch.
And we've got you covered with all the latest breaking news, the stories that matter. David Jennings has that coming up next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.